Nothing like a bunch of tacos to get you ready to sit and listen to a lecture for a while. So I'll try to keep this last one short and sweet because I'd like us to have plenty of time to talk in our time of discussion, question and answer. Certain things that have been said just in passing. One of the downsides when you're trying to fit a lot of content into a short amount of time is that there's certain things you mention, and it's kind of like prone to misunderstanding, or you know, sort of a loaded statement. So I'd be very happy to go back and unpack any of that, discuss it in more detail, or clarify some things, or if there's another topic in Proverbs we haven't mentioned, or you know, whatever, we'll look at it. But the three things we're going to look at right now fall into this category of heart government. So if I was going to complete our little diagram here, it's going to be right here in this third one, heart government. I do not want to give you the impression with my little diagram here that this is what the whole book of Proverbs looks like. I mean, really, the whole book of Proverbs just looks like that. There's a lot of different ways you could break down the content that's in the book, but I think there's some themes that come back over and over. So by heart, and this one, heart government, is really very closely aligned with this idea of interfacing with the world. But part of interfacing with the world is, remember we said interfacing with the world, the idea is like the world is like this console or this control panel that you have to be able to know what all the different instruments do, whether it's the one of speech or interacting with leaders or spending your money or developing friendships and relationships, marriage, children. But the biggest, maybe the biggest part in Proverbs, the biggest part of that control panel is you. To interface with the world, you have to be able to interface with yourself. You have to know what kind of a person you are. You have to know how to work yourself. How do you work? And Proverbs has a lot to say about that. We're just going to look at three of the topics in Proverbs that concern this. The first one we're going to look at is the area of decision making. Let's look at Proverbs 16. Verse 33. This is, by the way, this is a great little metric to say, how am I doing in this wisdom path that I'm on? The chapter 10 to 29 wisdom path is, here's where you really feel your lack of wisdom, is when it's time to make a decision. On a normal day, you can feel like, you know, I think I'm generally a pretty wise person. And then all of a sudden, it's like, I have to decide whether I want to, you know, stay living here, if I have to move, or if I get a job, or if I should pursue this relationship. And all of a sudden, it's like your want of wisdom or your lack of wisdom is where you start to feel it very, very painfully. And by the way, there's a really good verse we should remember from the book of James, right? When we're talking about wisdom and how we don't have enough of it. What does the book of James promise us? If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, right? He gives everybody what they need. So God has essentially given his children a promise like, listen, I'm committed to this. I'm committed to giving you the wisdom that you need to navigate this world. So let's look at Proverbs 16, verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Now this isn't about our decision, it's about the Lord's decision. So what does this tell us? It's a very famous verse to talk about how even the seemingly random events of our universe are part of God's providential governing of the universe. So the first thing we need to learn about governing our own hearts is to understand God's government, that he's in control of everything. I think it's overwhelming us when we're making decisions is how little control we seem to have, but we start the book of Proverbs with this acknowledgement. Who is God? What is God like? This is to cheat and get us started on this worksheet. What is God like? He's in control of all things. He's sovereign. He's in charge of all things. Chapter 19. Let's jump down a couple chapters. Chapter 19, verse 20 to 21. Listen to advice and accept instruction, that you may gain wisdom in the future. Many, many, many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand, right? So God has made us part of our royal dignity, okay? If we said our introduction, we've seen it a couple times. God is destining his people to be kings and queens. You see this, by the way, all the way back in Israel, where God calls Israel, his people Israel, out of Egypt, out of slavery in Egypt. He says, I will make you kings and priests, kings and priests. Fast forward all the way to the end of the Bible, the book of Revelation. We give thanks to God, who through Jesus Christ has called us to be kings and priests. So kings and priests, being a king, being royalty, is part of what it means to be part of the people of God. But being royalty doesn't just mean you wear a crown and, you know, you give speeches. Part of it means is that your decisions matter. Like what? Like that's part of the dignity that God gives to his children, is that he allows you to sit there, to reason, and to make a judgment, to make a decision about something. Those who fear the Lord, again, fear the Lord is the beginning of the wisdom. God looms large in my view. Those who fear the Lord make different kinds of decisions than people that do not, than the worldlings. Seeing God rightly puts us in our place. It puts all in perspective. Okay. Again, Proverbs, very big on humility. So we didn't have any topic of these that was humility, but that's part of heart government. That's part of how we look at ourselves. One of the places that humility is needed is when we're making decisions. It's acknowledging our own limitations, which is chapter 19, what we just, he says, yo, you got many plans. What does he say? Chapter 19, verse 21. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it's the purpose of the Lord that will stand. In other words, when you're making decisions, one of the first things to acknowledge is like, I could do my best to make a decision here. I might get it wrong. And God may just like wipe this entire decision off the board. And like, that's okay. Humbles us, right? So humility recognizes our own limitations. I cannot assume that I know all the plans that the Lord has. So we have an epidemic of Christians that we're not progressing down the trail, the chapter 10 through 29, fear the Lord trail. We have little fear of God. We have little knowledge of his ways. And so when we're growing in wisdom, how does that help us make our decisions? First of all, I've always find it fascinating that we don't think enough about the fact that the Bible tells us to grow in wisdom. What can we conclude from that? That means when we're making a decision about something, what do we need? We need to be able to think through it. Okay. Now, most of the time when it's time for me to make a decision, that's not what I prefer. I'm looking to the Lord and asking him to give me the thumbs up or a thumbs down. If God gave you a thumbs up, a thumbs down all the time, you wouldn't need wisdom that much in your decision making. You would just need God to give you a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But according to the book of Proverbs, the way he's actually set it up, this is part of your dignity as kings and queens, as children of God. Part of the dignity that he's given you is the responsibility to think through these matters and to make decisions. Now, what should we expect from God in our decision making? Again, what we tend to expect is information. We tend to expect for God to give me information about this decision that I need to make. But what we should be looking for is, through the power of his Holy Spirit, a total recalibration of our minds. Isn't that what we've been seeing in Proverbs? Just trying to get us to think different. People who think different decide different, right? We make different kinds of decisions, and so that's what we should expect. Another part of humility, again, this humility and decision-making go together. Humility, what's a concrete expression of humility in the book of Proverbs, is that it seeks counsel. Does not attempt to make decisions without good counsel, without seeking out godly counselors and asking for their input, especially in matters of great significance. So God's community, he fills it with people who have spiritual gifts of insight and wisdom. That's true, certainly true now in the church, certainly true now in the New Testament church, but it's always been true of God's people. Look again, you look back all the way, the people of Israel in the wilderness, God poured out the spirit of wisdom onto people. So in other words, if you needed a decision made, there was people you could talk to. God will not leave you without a counselor. He won't. He won't leave his people without a counselor. There are people that you can talk to. So don't believe that lie, like there's no one I can talk to about this. Well, you should try. One of our problems, let's talk about social media again in decision making. Part of our problem with social media and having thousands of loose ties with people is that you can always get an amen chorus going for whatever decision you want to make. You can literally go home and today and type, I've decided that I'm going to move to Tibet and I'm going to become a monk, you know, and you'll get a bunch of people being like, that's thumbs up, love it, you know, excited for you, so excited about this new change in your life. And what does that do for you? That confirms you in your decision, right? Don't pretend you're not immune, that you're immune to that. You're not. None of us are. None of us are immune to the power of an amen chorus. So be very cautious about opening yourselves up to that. When the people that are closest to you, the godly counselors in your life, may be like, listen, this is probably not a good idea. Have you been to Tibet before? You know, But you can get that reinforcement from social media, right? The not real, that's not true counsel according to the book of Proverbs. The counselors that the son is urged to seek out in the book of Proverbs would have been recognized by the people of God. They would have been authorized counselors. It wasn't just you like calling up your bestie and being like, what do you think? Said, I think you should do whatever makes you happy. Like that's not what the counselor is going to say. And also, humility recognizes that God's purposes never waver. Okay? Unlike our purposes, which waver constantly, some of us, our purposes have wavered even in the past 24 hours, but humility recognizes that God's purposes never waver. And what this does is it relativizes the importance of our choices. They are not ultimate. Okay? And this really should give you a feeling of freedom. I know there's a decision-making paralysis that sets in where we're so terrified of what's going to happen. I just want to tell you, the vibe of the New Testament, or sort of the air that you breathe in the New Testament, is one of astonishing freedom. It is not that terror of, if I take the wrong step here, I'm going to step off the golden, what's it called, the yellow brick road, and then I'm never going to get to the best, what God has best for me. Christians are supposed to move through life with much more confidence, much more faith, much more security and peace than that. Like I'm seeking to follow Christ and I'm making this decision. I've listened to my godly counselors. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I think he's got this. And so I'm going to step forward in faith and it's going to be okay. All right. So that's a little bit about decision-making. Obviously much more we could dig into about that. Oh, there was one other thing I want to say about humility there. Humility emboldens us to make fearless decisions then. Okay. You can make fearless decisions, which let me tell you, there's a lot of times the right decision that you need to make in life, you will not make it unless you're brave. Right? You have to have courage to make the right decision sometimes. Okay, so let's look at the next one. Everybody's favorite in Proverbs, the subject of sloth or laziness. Chapter 6. Now notice where we're at now. We're in the trailhead. Chapters 1 through 9. This is the father saying, son, one of the reasons that you might choose to not follow the path of the Christian life is out of laziness, because you're trying to choose the path of least resistance. Chapter 6, let's just look at 6 to 11. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. That ant, she don't got no chief or officer or ruler, but she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long are you going to lay down there, sluggard? When are you going to get up from sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. And poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. It is this distinctive topic of work ethic that gives Proverbs its bourgeois reputation and makes it particularly distasteful to our work-averse generations. Yes, our work-averse generations. The father sees, first of all, it's true the father many times says something like, son, it is a practical necessity for you to work. Like if you don't work, it's like you're not going to have what you need. Like he says, the ant is preparing its food in the summer. It's getting ready for the winter that's coming. So there's a practical component to it that says, listen, you're going to need to work. At some point, you got to make money, right? That's true. There's a practical component. But also, it's not a law. Remember, that's going back to the broke perspective. It's not the point of Proverbs is not to say a person who does not work hard is going to starve to death. First of all, is that true? No, we all know a bunch of lazy people who are just rolling in dough. They're doing great. You know, there are plenty of exceptions to the general principle there. There's tons of people that have found a way to make a comfortable living, and they're completely, you know, they would definitely fall in the category of a sluggard according to the book of Proverbs. But what the father is saying is that it's a high-risk proposition. It's high risk to be lazy. But not only that, so that's all the practical side. But then we want to dig down to the underlying worldview. Underlying worldview is work is good. It's good. It's good for you. In other words, if the father would say to the son, son, if there's a way that you could find a way that you could have all your needs met, all your bills paid, and you would never have to do another day of work the rest of your life, that would not be good for you. That wouldn't be good for you. It's not good for you to try to find a way to arrange things so that you'll never have to work again. And I think it's important for us to mention because I think it's the generations below me. There wasn't a lot of this when I was coming up, but I see there's a lot of it now. There's a certain drive to be like, listen, if you're not retired by the time you're 42, like, what are you even doing? It's like, this is like thing that like, if you play your cards right, then you should be done working totally, or at least your work should be severely minimized by the time you reach a certain age. We have a very negative view of work. I think that's fair to say. You guys can correct me if you think I'm wrong later. In other words, it's not the good life. Proverbs, the father's repeatedly drawing a picture, or painting a picture, I should say, for the son of what the good life is like. And the good life is a life of work. God made us to rule, right? Genesis. Now, again, we have a tendency to think like, oh, God made me to be a king or a queen, aka a person who never has to do any work. Like, no, that's not what it's about at all. God says to Adam, I've made you to rule, and so you're going to work. Our ruling is work. How do we rule the world? How do we exercise dominion in God's world? Well, we do it by work. He has made us to shape our world in blessed and beautiful ways. Okay, would you rather not work or go to work at your dream job? That's the question I ask people sometimes, like try to help them think about this right. We have a negative view of work. You say, okay, what would you rather? Would you rather never have to work again? Or would you rather get like have your complete dream job that you'd have to work even more than you do right now? I think most people think, oh, I'd rather have certainly most men, I think, would say, yes, I'd rather have the dream job where I have to work even more hours than I do right now. You see, you were made for that. You're made to form your world, to shape your world in blessed ways. Now, there are, let's say this, there are dishonorable jobs in the world. We don't have to go list them all, but it's important that we have this category in our mind. There are dishonorable jobs. Well, how would we define a dishonorable job? They are jobs that do harm, and there are jobs that defy God. Okay, so a dishonorable job, a job that is not fitting for a Christian, is a job that does harm to people. If you're in an industry that's doing harm to people, you need to get out of it, right? Or if you're in an industry that shakes its fist at God and defies his rule, if that's part of your job description, then you need to find a new job. That's not acceptable for us as believers. So there are dishonorable jobs, but it is honorable, it is good, it is right to have a job that serves people. Right? Now, if you want to, I find a lot of Christians, there's a lot of good books about this. I'm sure your pastors can recommend them to you. There's excellent books about helping Christians think of their job as being something that's done for the glory of God. And there's a lot of deep thinking you can do about that. But let me just give you the shortcut answer. Who are you serving? Okay? Whether you're working at McDonald's, whether you're in some kind of ministry capacity, whether you're in finance or whether you're some kind of a bureaucrat, you can ask, who am I serving? Who am I serving? And think of your work in that way, and that is to truly do a job that honors God. It's also honorable to make money and to serve people with the money that you make, to serve your children, to serve your family, to serve your brothers and sisters in your church. It is honorable for you to make money and to do that. So the father is telling the son, to be lazy is to give up this high honor. Okay, I think this perspective on work also implies that our world is broken. There's work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done because the world is not in the form that it needs to be. And so God has dispatched his people to form the world into what it needs to be. Now, if you read the verses again in the back of the handout, there's a whole list of verses about sloth in the book of Proverbs. Again, this is another thing like gluttony and drunkenness and gossip. There's another one I like you to, we should be careful about with the book of Proverbs, and that is the sin of sloth. Sleeping in on your day off till 11 or 12, or like maybe the numbers go even higher, is not the sin of sloth. Okay. The sin of sloth is a certain attitude about work that perceives work as a distasteful thing to be minimized, to I don't want to do it, right? If you did it, you did it when you didn't want to do it, that means you're probably not guilty of the sin of sloth, okay? The lazy are associated with sleep, with desire. This is one of the interesting things I discovered in studying the Proverbs about work, is that the sluggard is associated with excessive and unrealistic desire. So there is a whole generation, well, I would say the generation that's now entering the workplace. And literally, like you go to an elementary class right now, like my kids, their school, you ask their classmates, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? They all want to be YouTubers. Like it's not like, and again, when we were growing up, we're like, I want to be a doctor. Like all we'd heard of was like doctors and soldiers. That's like all policemen. We all want to be policemen or doctors. I can't remember what else, but those like the three things that we could choose from, right? And our kids now, they want to be like YouTubers. Like someone needs to be honest with kids and tell them like that's not a, like that's most likely that's probably not going to be a an honorable profession. Well, maybe there may be. You may disagree with me about that. That's what Proverbs is for, to think through those things. But we need to steer kids, if you're a teacher and you're in an education way, we want to steer children towards honorable professions that serve others, right? That make, that form the world into God's, into a creation that glorifies God. The lazy are also associated with irrational fears. Everybody knows the proverb about, oh, there's a lion out there. If I go out there, I'm going to be killed. In other words, it's that now that is a proverb that's supposed to make you laugh a little bit. In other words, it's an irrational fear. Okay, there's a person who's paralyzed and they have these irrational fears is going to be a person who ends up not wanting to do anything at all. The sluggard is also, so this is probably also a very key one in our American society today, is the sluggard is associated with waste and ingratitude. So there's one where he talks about the sluggard. He says, I went by the house of the sluggard. I saw his vineyard and it was all overgrown and it was all wasted. Now, the thing about a vineyard is, unlike a garden that you might plant, a vineyard is a generational treasure. You don't grow a vineyard overnight, in a season, in two seasons. It takes years to cultivate a thriving vineyard. So the picture is, here's a son who has inherited a vineyard that's been passed down generation after generation. What is it? He's let it get overgrown with weeds. It's all fall. He's ruining this precious treasure, right? And we have to be very cautious that we don't treat our inheritance like that. Every Christian has an inheritance, right? Now, some of that is a spiritual inheritance that we have as sons and daughters of God through Christ Jesus. Others of are part of God's common grace to us. The fact that you are in the place that you live, in the place that you live, that you have the talents that you were born with, or that you've received through a good education, or that your parents have provided, or the things that all the things that you've inherited. So look about yourself, say, what have I inherited? And what have I done with it? Does it express waste and ingratitude? All right, and the last one. I know, it's the last one, buddy. Don't worry. It's the last one. Is about self-control. This is probably the most vague one to talk about under heart government. Heart government just is self-control. But I want us to think specifically about the verses in Proverbs that deal with anger. Okay, Proverbs has a lot to say about anger. Let's just look at chapter 16, verse 32. Right. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And he who rules his spirit is better than he who takes a city. Okay, so you're slow to anger. That's better than being a strong guy. Okay. Next chapter, chapter 17, verse 9. Whoever covers an offense seeks love. In other words, you're covering up this offense that's happened. It's because your desire is to have a loving environment. But he that repeats a matter separates close friends. Okay? You keep bringing something up, it's because you're determined to wreck the community. All right. So, you guys remember that part of Proverbs where he says these six things, this is from the trailhead, he says these six things that the Lord hates, seven are an abomination to him, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, feet that are swift and running to mischief. Right? You guys know those verses? The thing you notice, a lot of people don't notice about that passage, about the things that God hates, is that they're all community-destroying activities. what's the last one? What's the seventh one? The one that sows sows discord among the brothers. The brothers, see that? The community, the people of God, the family, the people who are causing division in the family. He says God hates that. And the things above are actually the first six are ways that you might go about breaking apart the community. So the picture of Proverbs, again, is that you are, in fact, as a human being made in the image of God, you are exerting an impact on the environment around you. Now, you may not feel like that. A lot of times we feel like what I do doesn't really affect anybody. I'm a very small person. I don't have a position of leadership. I don't have any status. I don't have any clout. I don't have a title. I don't have a lot of wealth. So what I do isn't affecting other people's lives. Absolutely you are. It is inevitable as a human being that you are exerting a large impact on the other people in your life. You know, people are always talking about how amazing ants are because they can lift, you know, X amount of times their body weight. You know, they can move ants so little, but they can move such big things. They got nothing on you. With the powers that God has invested you with, you are making an impact on the lives of the people around you, whether you're doing it intentionally or unintentionally. And that's why you look at those six things the Lord hates. What are they? They're all body parts. Eyes, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, feet that are, what's he saying is, you are like tricked out with all these weapons. You've got all this weaponry. You're like an armory. You're like an aircraft carrier of a person, bristling with all of this weaponry to cause damage. So here's the thing, you're either using the tools and the weapons God has given you, your looks, is that the way you look at people can be destructive. Certainly the way you talk about people can be destructive. The things that you do with your hands can be destructive. The places you go with your feet can be destructive, right? So that's the negative picture. But I would say throughout much of chapters 10 through 29 on the actual trail of wisdom, he tells a lot of the ways that you can use your powers for good. So you are a person of power. So we might say it like this. A person who does not exercise self-control is like a drunk driver. That's what they're like, right? And we have very harsh penalties for drunk driving because what you're doing is like you're taking this piece of machinery that's deadly, right? A car is actually a lot deadlier than a gun. You're operating this piece of machinery under the influence. In other words, you're not exercising control. Because you don't exercise control, you are destroying, you have the potential of destroying people's lives. If we don't exercise self-control as Christians by the power of the Spirit, then what's going on? We're like that drunk driver. We're just wreaking havoc in the world around us. And probably the most concrete way that the Proverbs talks about is through our anger, through our temper. So that's why he says you have to rule your spirit. He says the one who, what did he say back there in chapter 16, verse 32? Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. So what is, he uses, why would he compare that? Why would he say like being in having self-control is better than somebody who conquers a city? Why does his mind go to conquering? Because to rule yourself is like conquering. It's a battle. It's a campaign. It is not easy. There is resistance. It will take time, right? But it's absolutely a battle that you have to wage. Okay. And as good news is, as Christians, we are empowered. God has given us the resources that we need to get ourselves under control. Okay. And this is a theme that is steadily repeated in the New Testament as well. What is anger? Anger is the way that we communicate to others our displeasure. Anger is an impulse that we have to destroy the thing that we don't like. Okay? Anger always wants to destroy. That's why you see an angry person, they're tensed up and they're ready to fight, right? Especially guys, what is our instinct when we're angry? We are immediately looking for, what can I smash? Hulk must smash. What can I destroy, right? That's why the Hulk has become the whatever he is, the character that's like associated with anger, because that's what we all are kind of like when we're feeling this anger. So Proverbs focuses on the immoral use of anger. Now, one of the most fascinating things to me in the New Testament is to see what righteous anger looks like. Of course, you see that in the Lord Jesus Christ, who exercised, Jesus got angry. But he never used that anger. So again, it's almost like, what do you call that thing in your car? On the Fast and Furious movies, they're going fast and they want to go faster. Nitrous something? NOS? I know it's an energy drink. I guess it's a thing in cars. So what's the idea there? It's like, that's what anger is kind of like for you. Anger is supposed to fill you with this rush of adrenaline and power so that you can face down an enemy that's in front of you. And God made you with that capacity. Why? Because there's a real enemy in the world that you have to fight. And so Christians, we have to. There are times where it is right for you to be angry and it's wrong for you to not be angry, right? Where we should feel that. And then what we do is we feel that righteous anger. We look around for, what can I smash? What legitimate means has God given me to smash? Okay, so I've got some money. You can smash things with your money, right? You've got a vote. You can smash some stuff with your vote. You've got a voice that you can speak up. You can smash some things with your words, right? So the godly anger or righteous anger uses the legitimate means that God has given us to strike out against what is wrong, okay? But unrighteous anger, which we're much more familiar with, the wrath of man, is where we are filled with anger, usually because of some perceived slight against ourselves, and we want to smash somebody, right? Or we're causing harm to a person that we do not have the authority to harm. All right, so God's design is for us to live in his community in peace. These explosions of temper are not a show of strength, but they are a show of weakness. To show you haven't conquered your city yet, okay? So listen, and another thing to remember about anger, I'm sure we all have angry people in our lives. Give you a little hint for how to deal with angry people or something to remember when you're dealing with angry people. Anger always is birthed from pain. Now, I read this from no less a source than B.B. Warfield in his wonderful book talking about the emotions of Christ. And he says, what does it mean that Christ had anger? He says, we have to remember that anger at its most basic, at its root, its seed form of anger is pain. Something is hurting you. So I'm going to tell you, if you have an angry person in your life, which many of us do, realize when you're dealing with that person, have a little bit of compassion. Realize that anger is coming from a source of pain. Okay. So the wise, they know how to diffuse tension with other people. They're not triggered by impulse. Warriors are people who can fight against their own impulses, and they study gentle words. We don't have time to look at this in Proverbs, but we study gentle words. Gentle words don't just come out of your mouth. You have to study gentle words. So I encourage you, find gentle people in your life. Powerful, gentle people who don't, you can tell when they're upset, but they don't smash anybody. And study, what are they saying? How are they doing that? How are they doing that? How are they not letting these powerful weapons that God has given them, letting them loose to, you know, unleash destruction? And I'll say this about the way Proverbs works. The idea in Proverbs, again, is that we're people that have been invested with this armory or these powerful weapons and tools. That's what it means to be a human, to be made in the image of God, is to be having all this power that God has given us. Okay, and ultimately in Scripture, the person who proves themselves unworthy of those tools will lose them. You prove yourself unworthy of humanity, ultimately you lose it. You lose it. In the same way, a person drives drunk, causes some chaos, what we say is, you'll never drive again. We take away your driving privileges. And this is exactly the picture of the judgment that's to come. Those who prove unworthy of their humanity, those who prove unable or unwilling to study the path of wisdom and learn to control their spirit, will finally lose what they were unwilling to control.